So what today I wanted to talk about discouragement, because inspiration for this is that I was told last week that there was someone who someone told me their friend came to our sittings for once or twice and felt so discouraged by their mind, what their experience of meditation was. They thought it was hopeless and never came back. And so it occurred to me, well, maybe there are other people who get discouraged from time to time in their meditation practice and in their lives, and that maybe discouragement is an important topic to address. Now, I think it's interesting, the word discouragement, because I guess literally it means lack of courage, the absence of courage or something. But it's more than just the absence of something. It's the presence of a certain kind of criticalness, certain kind of sense of disappointment, certain kind of sense of frustration, of pushing back at something, of being judgmental. Something here is bad, something here is wrong, something here is not what it's supposed to be here. There's some activity going on. It isn't just simply the absence of courage or faith or confidence. So it's a kind of a doing, that we do it. We actively do discouragement. We do being discouraged. Now, when people first come to meditate, I think it's very easy for some people to get discouraged, because for some people it's a big shock to stop and notice what's going on in their minds, and to notice how much their mind is out of control, or how busy their mind is, the monkey mind, that swings from just one tree to the other without ever resting, from one idea to another. And so it's very easy to suddenly discover how restless the mind is and say, well, this is impossible. I can't do this. I'll never be able to calm my mind or sit still or pay attention to what's happening, because my mind just races off. As soon as I try to pay attention, the mind races off, and 10 minutes later I notice that I'm off. So I suppose it can be a little bit discouraging to have that kind of experience. However, it's very common for new people into meditation to discover their mind is out of control. The mind is kind of wild or restless. And that rather than being discouraged by it, I encourage people to feel some satisfaction that now they've discovered something about their mind which maybe they didn't know before. They discovered that their mind is wild or uncontrollable or restless or agitated or afraid or whatever it might be. Because it's easily possible to go back to the old way where you don't know that, or you ignore the fact, but it's still happening. The mind is still restless and agitated and wild and racing around being distracted, but you're kind of engaged in your life and not paying attention to that. And a lot of people in our society go around asleep, they're numb to what's actually going on their insides. And to the degree to which they're numb, they're out of touch. And the sad thing is, when you're out of touch with yourself, it automatically implies being out of touch with others. Because you have to have a self that's here a little bit, that someone else can meet, or you have to be able to notice you can meet someone else. So they really go closely together, hand in hand. Our ability to connect to others is connected to our ability to be really connected and honestly to ourselves, know what's going on in here. To the degree to which we're strangers to ourselves, we become alienated from others. So it's better to know that the mind is restless than to go back into a state and not know that. So there's some improvement. So if you realize that, it's some improvement, there can be some satisfaction. Oh, great. The mind is also malleable. They have wonderful words in Buddhist psychology for the capacity of the mind to be changed. The mind is malleable. The mind is not, much of the mind is not this hard and fast physical stuff. And the mind is made up of often ideas and concepts and feelings, and these things are malleable, can be changed. And it's quite something. Another word is pliable. Because one of the states of mind that's considered very desirable in Buddhist psychology is a state of mind where the mind is pliable. The mind has become pliable. For many people, the mind is brittle, or the heart is brittle. It's kind of very, but it's actually, the mind can be quite pliable. It's kind of a difference between having a pliable like a leaf, or like a blade of grass in the wind, just moves back and forth. The reason a palm tree doesn't blow over in a hurricane is that it can bend quite nicely. So if the mind can bend and flow and be pliable, then much more peace in the changeable world. So the mind is malleable, the mind can be changed, the heart can be changed. And that's very important to realize that, so that you don't have to kind of just accept the fact that my mind's always going to be restless, my mind's always going to be wild and out of control. The mind can be changed. However, the mind is not necessarily so easy to tame. There's an ancient saying from the time of the Buddha, quote from the Buddha, he said, better than taming, the word can be either tame or conquer, but better than taming 100 enemies in battle is taming your mind. The mind can be tamed, but in order to do that, one of the first qualities that you have to learn to develop is patience. And so it's a little bit of a maybe kind of twist, because we expect to be able to do it right away. But the way we do it is a little bit often roundabout. We have to first learn to be patient. And the very act of bringing patience to the restless and wild mind is beginning to have that change, to change things around. Now, one of the causes of discouragement is that we feel like things are out of control. Some people will very much want to control their external world, but also their inner world. They want to be in control. And they only feel safe if they're controlling things. And to a certain degree, we need to learn some commonsensical control of our environment and ourselves. But the neurotic need for control is a real hindrance that makes the mind brittle, keeps the mind from being pliable and malleable, fluid. And to think that we can control always our inner experience is a setup for more discouragement. So one of the things we learn as we meditate is to identify what our inner experience is to some degree, and then we learn to flow with it. One of the beautiful things that happens on longer retreats, maybe for different people it's different length of time, is you come to a retreat, and the first day of a meditation retreat, maybe it's really hard. You've had a hard week, it's been difficult, terrible things happened to you before you came to the retreat, you're exhausted and tired. And so you sit down and just all this exhaustion, tiredness, and all this agitation from your week is there with you. And then your person can easily decide, oh, it's hopeless, I chose the wrong retreat to come to, the wrong time to be on retreat, and feel really discouraged, well, I blew it. I should have waited until the February retreat. Why am I sitting the August retreat? And then the next day of the retreat, the second day of the retreat, the tiredness wears off and you're not so restless anymore and the mind gets calm and feels really nice. Oh, calm. This is really great. I've succeeded. I managed to tame that mind, I'm now in charge, and I managed to get the mind calm, and that's really great. And the third day happens. And now the mind is filled with sadness. Oh my God, what happened? I was so calm yesterday, and now I just feel so sad. And this is terrible, and why did I come on this retreat? And it's hopeless after all, and you feel really discouraged again. And then the fourth day comes. And calm returns, but this time the calm returns with a lot of joy. Wow. This is really great. I'm a great yogi. I hope someone notices how good I am at this. And then the next day happens. And then next day it's a tremendous amount of restlessness. Can't sit still for a moment. What happened? Yesterday I was sitting for 3 hours, you know, and blink of an eye. And now I can't even sit still for 2 seconds. And my body hurts, and my mind hurts, and my heart hurts. And these teachers are giving bad Dharma talks. And the people around me, they don't have to sit still either. And really, we don't want to get discouraged in ourselves, but we get discouraged, and you know, our discouragement spills over to blaming other people for who they are. And then the next day, things get really still again. A lot of joy, and mind feels really pliable. And sooner or later, the person catches on. And what they catch on is, things are always changing. And when they realize that things are always changing, it's the nature of our mental state, so in our lives to be constantly changing, it's possible to develop more equanimity and patience about that. And not to jump to conclusions. Oh, this means I'm a great meditator. This means that it's hopeless. This means I'll never get anywhere. But many people live in the midst, they take up residence and live in the midst of the particular state of mind, the particular mood of the moment, and will make many conclusions based on that. Part of the wisdom that comes from practicing a long time, paying attention, is to see how things are constantly changing and to start having some equanimity about that and not be so concerned about you needing to control, be in control of what happens. Rather, to develop kind of graciousness. Oh. Now, one of the ways to develop some graciousness around this is to realize that states of mind, moods, are just that. They're just a state of mind. Oh. There's discouragement is a state of mind. Oh, it's discouragement. But in the middle of a state of mind, we tend to be enwrapped by it and believe it and smothered by it and entangled with it. And it seems like this is the biggest truth that's present right now. It's, we take it so seriously. But one of the functions of mindfulness is to kind of lift ourselves out of the mood or the emotional state we're sunk into and see, wait a minute, it's just a mood. It's the mood of the moment. That's all it is. And put it in a different context. It's not who we are. A mood or state of mind is not who we are. It's an aspect, it's a piece, it's a fraction of who we are in any given moment. And if we can realize it's only a fraction of who we are, then we can have a little different relationship to it than if we think it's the whole thing. One of the great practices, one of the great mantras around strong states is the mantra, wow. Wow. I was talking to someone today about her difficulty with sexual attraction and how she gets kind of consumed by her sexual attraction. And I said, yeah, sometimes it's really amazing. It's like standing at the base of Niagara Falls and you look at all this power, this energy coming pouring down the Niagara cliffs, and the power and the energy of that is, people stand there just, oh, wow. Sometimes our sexual energy is like that. You just have to stand there and go, wow. And to do that, to be able to say, wow, separates you a little bit. That part that's amazed is not so entangled and caught up in it. Wow. I didn't know anybody could get this depressed. Wow. Wow. Or angry. Wow. Wow, look at that. I'm on fire in anger. Wow. So it's a great mantra. You should try it sometime. Wow. It's just a state of mind. not to discount its importance, not to make it a kind of second-class citizen and repress it and push it away, but to kind of put it in its proper place. It's just a state of mind. State of minds come and go. State of mind is only a piece of who we are. That masquerade sometimes is all of us, is the final conclusion. So part of the function of mindfulness is just simply our ability to see what's actually happening in the moment for what it is. And to see discouragement as discouragement. Oh, I'm discouraged. And then to leave it alone. Not to leave it alone so that it just kind of continues on its merry way, discouraging you, but rather to hold your gaze on the discouragement without adding to it or without criticizing it or coming to conclusions because of it. Just, oh, I'm discouraged. Just to see it. Oh, this is what's happening. Oh, I've been told this happens from time to time in human beings. It comes with being a human being. Oh, and now it's my turn. Wow. Here it is. It's present. And then notice all the conclusions that you tend to make based on discouragement. I can't do it. This is not the right time to do it. These are the wrong people to do it with. You know, or it's not happening the way it's supposed to happen. I haven't arrived yet. I haven't gotten it yet. There's all these inner voices, all the inner conclusions that are so easy for them to spill out when we're feeling discouraged. And if we're living in the discouragement, we tend to believe those voices. But if you can get the wow perspective, or at least the mindful perspective, just sees it as it is, kind of say, oh, it's just a state of mind. And you can watch the flowing forth of the conclusions. Oh, these are just conclusions. They're just thoughts. I don't have to believe them. I don't have to not believe them. I just can leave them alone. One of the great little teachings in our tradition was when an Indian teacher, some student came, practitioner came to the teacher and said, I guess was complaining or saying about difficulty with her mother. You know, needing to work out the relationship with her mother and all the stuff with her mother. And the teacher said something that really helped this woman liberate her a little bit at the moment. And the teacher said, the thoughts of your mother are not your mother. And now why do you think that was liberating? But our thoughts are just our thoughts. They're not actually the things we're often thinking about. Like, so to see the conclusions we make comes out of discouragement, it's just thoughts. And not to get involved. Just, oh, take it with a grain of salt kind of thing. To feel the discouragement in our body, that's one of the ways of holding the gaze on discouragement, is to feel where we feel depressed or held down or frustrated in our body, the physical sensations of that. They just hang out there. As we do this, we might see some of the reasons why we're discouraged. And there are a whole slew, many reasons why a person can get discouraged. One of them might be that they have some idea of progress and they haven't made enough progress. And is it necessary to make progress? Is it necessary to hold on to progress with expectation? Is the notion of progress tied into our sense of self, our self-worth? Progress is a very dangerous topic for meditators. It trips up more meditators than almost anything else. Wanting progress, discouraged that it doesn't happen, afraid when it does happen, measuring themselves every once in a while. I mean, I remember my early sittings. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous, right? But I wouldn't go more than 5 breaths into a retreat before I was measuring to see how well I'd done. 5 breaths into a 10-day retreat. Well, then I let it go for another 3 or 4 breaths before I checked again. How well am I doing here? Being caught by the notions of progress and expectation of making progress, measuring ourselves, is a great cause of discouragement. When things happen that we don't want to happen, we can get discouraged. And this has something to do with the notion of control, as a notion that has connected to the idea of expectation, as a notion of being of expectation, that certain things are acceptable and other things are not. Part of the, what comes with malleability, the pliability of the mind, the freedom of the heart that comes with practice, comes not from the particular states of mind that arise and pass, but rather how we relate to it. The content of our mind is not so important, but rather how we relate to it. What our experience is not, the particular experience we're having is not that important, but rather how we're relating to that experience. And this is a very important move in mindfulness practice, is to switch your sense of well-being, your sense of identity, in a sense, from your experience of yourself, your experience of life, to how you relate to that experience. So my experience might be that I'm discouraged. And how do I relate to that? Do I get all entangled with it? Do I judge it? Do I try to push it away? Do I get discouraged because I'm discouraged? Or could we have, can I have a relationship of just being open and just allow it to be there? Let it float, in a sense, in the mind. Oh, discouragement. I can be really happy. Have wonderful spiritual bliss. And I can grab onto it. That's it. I got it. Finally got it. They told me, you know, that that would happen eventually, and I got it. But spiritual bliss is just another experience. The experience is not the point. The point is, how do you relate to that experience? And it's really easy to get attached to bliss. And that it can be a real setup for suffering. A person can have a little bit of bliss in their meditation one day, and the next day it's not there. And that's a source of discouragement. I thought I finally arrived. I had it right. Now I have it wrong. I must be doing something terrible that I don't have that bliss. I'm unspiritual. Yesterday I was spiritual, now I'm unspiritual. You know, there are all kinds of conclusions we can make that can bring discouragement to us. And we're attached to that particular experience, that bliss. And I've known people, I've done it, certainly, who've had some experience of joy, calm, delight, bliss in meditation. And then it's gone away, and then been very discouraged and tinkered and forced and huffed and puffed to try to get it back. As if that experience was the answer, the solution. It's certainly very pleasant to have bliss, but the point in mindfulness practice is not your experience, but how you relate to it. And your relationship to it is a little bit more ephemeral. That's why people often don't think it's important. We're kind of, many of us are kind of object oriented, or many of us are experience oriented. We want an experience out there we can pay attention to, notice, and claim as our own. But real freedom doesn't come from the experience you have. So it's not about matter tinkering to get the right experience in meditation. Rather, it is learning how to become free of any experience by focusing on how you hold any experience that arises. So when the mind is restless, how do you hold that? How do you relate to that? Is there a kind of acceptance, an equanimity of that? When the mind is, you know, whatever. So discouragement. Now the beautiful thing about our relationship to experience, that's something that is born in the present moment. Just in this very moment, how we relate to what's happening. To notice that. Is it possible to shift it? Not to change our experience or change our mood or our judgments, but can we kind of create more space or more room so we can just kind of float there? Just kind of see, oh, there it is. To bring the wow perspective. Wow. It can change things dramatically. With a meditative life, meditative practice, it's not always so clear what's really happening in terms of our spiritual development. And so the discouragement that arises out of measuring our progress or coming to some conclusion based on what's happening right now, we actually often don't know really what's going on. Lots of people who've had a lot of difficulty in their spiritual life and spent time being very discouraged will months or years later realize that was the most important times of my life, that difficulty. Because, you know, many causes, but because it really developed compassion for me. It was so hard for me, it finally broke through my heart, it softened my heart enough that I could start feeling compassion for myself and for others. And I had no idea that compassion was what was being developed when I was struggling so much. And if I'd known that, I wouldn't have had need to get discouraged about the difficulty, because it was like the most wonderful thing that happened to me was compassion or patience or generosity or courage or confidence. Or there's many things that develop kind of we don't necessarily see at the moment while we're in the middle of it. Part of the suffering of discouragement is that it tends to be one of these states that, like in relationship to meditation practice, it's one of these states that is about the practice. So we tend to keep it off the stage of attention. For example, very narrowly, we're focusing on the breath and breathing with the breath, trying to focus on it. We can't do it very well. The mind keeps slipping off and going into fantasy or whatever. And then we get discouraged. We keep trying and focusing. We have trouble, we get discouraged. Discouragement is about the practice. So we don't pay attention to that because it's about the practice. Practice is to pay attention to the breath. And so we don't have to pay attention to the discouragement about the practice. We just have to try to practice more on the breath. And part of the art of mindfulness is learn how to open up the field of awareness to include everything. And so even our judgments about the practice, we practice with, we look at clearly. And so discouragement, well, part of the reasons people suffer on discouragement is they often leave it as something, well, I'm not supposed to pay attention to that. That's just kind of about the practice. Now, discouragement is certainly different from frustration, but discouragement can be a very, very important teacher for us. Because, and it happens, discouragement will happen both in very subtle and very gross levels as people do a spiritual practice. And it can happen at almost any degree of maturity in spiritual practice that some discouragement can arise. And it's a very important teacher, and it's very important to pay attention to it, not to leave it off on the side. Because it can teach us a lot about our expectations, it can teach us a lot about our values, some of them which are maybe a little bit off, what we think is important. It can teach us a lot about our self-identity, what we're holding on to in terms of who we think we need to be. It can teach us a lot about our intentions, our motivations in life. And so there's a really wonderful opportunity to refine our self-knowledge and maybe rectify it a little bit when we get discouraged. To go back and look at the cause of that discouragement and question those voices. Question the conclusions. Question where it's arising out of. Notice the motivations and expectation. Notice the judgments that feed into it and create it. For example, when I remember my early years of sitting, I would sit every day, twice a day, and it was very nice. And I was very dedicated to it, and I would get pretty settled and calm and felt pretty good by the end of my sitting. And I didn't really know it. It was kind of unconscious, but the intention for those sittings was to get calm. And the value or the understanding that I had, kind of somewhat semi-consciously, was the purpose of meditation is to get calm. And because I was able to get somewhat calm each time I sat, it was reinforced. This is what spiritual life is really about, being calm. And then I went on retreat. And the retreat are these wonderful truth tellers of our understanding and our intentions. Because there I had to follow through on that much further. It wasn't just simply one or two sittings a day. It was like 9-10 sittings a day. And the motivation to be calm wasn't sustainable. The sittings would be much more challenging than just, my knees would be on fire or something, or feelings or emotions would bubble up that had been repressed for years, or all kinds of interesting stuff would happen. And so I realized how much I was living in this illusion that meditation was, that I was living this expectation of calm was really the point. And I was living that understanding that calm was the point. And I didn't see it in my daily sitting. I only saw the degree to which that I was operating in retreat where that couldn't be sustained. And so I got to look at that very honestly and fully and see that that wasn't needed. That just got in the way. And so then when I went back from retreat to my daily sitting practice, I was able to unburden myself of this both understanding and this expectation of but calm was really the point. And that was really important. Now, was that clear? What I said? So discouragement is actually a very important teacher for us. And rather than being discouraged that you're discouraged, you might actually take it as a good sign that here's something for me to learn now. I need to really learn something about myself here. What is it that's extra? What is it that I can drop? And meditation is a very good place to do this in, because you can take as a premise that in meditation practice, discouragement is completely unnecessary. It's the one place in life where you can take the premise that discouragement is completely unnecessary, that whatever the basis for you getting discouraged is, whatever the conclusions, whatever the judgments that bring the discouragement on, you can take as a premise it's false. I'm not saying it's always false, but you take it as a premise that it's false. So in this place, it's safe to really turn around, really look at that and question it thoroughly. In daily life kind of discouragement, maybe you're not quite so sure. You can take that as a premise, and so you kind of hold back and resist looking really deeply or resist experimenting with dropping that judgment. But in meditation, at least, there's actually no conclusions that need to be operating in order for you to be free at this very moment right now. So it's actually, I find it a very powerful place to look, to use discouragement to look back into what's actually making us who we are. So discouragement, I think, is an inevitable part of meditation practice. Some people have it sooner, some people later, some people sooner and later. And you need to know. You need to know that you could expect it to appear. And that your task is when it appears is to look at it, to bring attention to it, learn how not to identify with it, learn how to have the wow perspective that kind of is larger than the experience. And learn to investigate into it, into the judgments and conclusions that are bringing it on. And if you do that, I think you'll find, begin finding your capacity for the pliable mind, the free mind. And the mind will change. And you'll make progress. So how does that sound? Any questions? Anybody discouraged listening to all that? Yes.
One area that I run into discouragement from time to time is kind of in the larger life and trying to bring Dharma practice into daily life and sort of the circus of beings that one runs into, you know, present company. So. They don't know the Dharma from, you know, from a hot dog. So. And I know that, I think to myself, well, you know, if I treat them well, I show that I'm harmless, and I'm working for the benefit of their benefit, and they can see that, then they'll see that, you know, aggression and petulance and, you know, all the other, you know, the normal skill set isn't necessarily useful. But this isn't always so. I mean, well, let's just say, it takes a long time, so long that it's easy to get discouraged about it, you know. And I know at some level they're actually expressing their own discouragement, you know. But maybe, and a lot of what you said, you know, is very useful in that. But maybe you could address it.
So let me see if I followed you. You get discouraged because other people are acting in ways that you don't think are very healthy. And you would like, and you get discouraged because you're discouraged by their behavior, discouraged that you can't make an impact on them.
Well, it's a mixture of things. I'm imagining that beings in general, when treated reasonably, you know, reasonably well, and with the intention of not harming, you know, sort of trying to doing one's best to follow the Dharma in everyday life, that the natural response to that is one where the usually considered unskillful behaviors of, you know, the people demonstrate in daily life tend to sort of dissolve and they tend to, you know, open up. So, in fact, in some cases, they're very recalcitrant to do this.
Right.
And then, you know, it feels like an infinite amount of work. It feels like, you know, it can feel really a lot like a lot of effort is placed into an infinite well of, you know, the giant hole.
So this is a very important area, I think, then for you, and probably the area of investigation needs to be in who you think you are, and your sense of responsibility, your sense of trying to have an impact on people, and why you're trying to do that. There's a very famous Mahayana sutra called the Diamond Sutra, that one of the famous refrains in this discourse is. You should try to save all beings, while at the same time knowing there are no beings to be saved. Or it's kind of similar to T.S. Eliot's line, to teach me to care and not to care.
Excuse me?
Teach me to care and not to care at the same time. So, it sounds to me like there's something extra that you're bringing in your involvement with other people. I hear something really beautiful from you, that you really want to have the help and try to soften people and make their lives a little easier. But I think there's something a little bit extra added to that that is causing you discouragement. If you're expecting to have results, for example, that's extra.
We talked a little bit about being noticing discouragement or noticing something negative, and I wanted to apply that to everyday life.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm in a really bad mood, and then I say, well, boy, wow, you're in a really bad mood. That doesn't take me out of bad mood. And so maybe it's the same thing, I'm expecting results, but it's more of, is there anything else about, other than observing it and sort of having the wow effect that you can do about the negative?
I would suggest maybe don't be so quick to come to the conclusion that the wow doesn't take you out of it. It doesn't get rid of it. doesn't stop it from happening. Maybe the moment you go, wow, you're a little bit separated from it. You're not so caught by it. And if you share that wow with someone else and say, you know, wow, I'm really upset with you. You know, I want to tell you something really amazing. or just simply noticing that, you might be more careful with your speech. And just a little care in your speech might actually make a big difference. So don't discount the value of just really clearly seeing what's happening. You can make better choices then. You might not feel any better, but you're making better choices. And many of us, we tend in our culture to focus very much on our state of experience, state of our mood. We very much identify with that as really kind of being center of who we are. There are other people who focus much more on their choices they make as being more who they are. And so they don't care so much how they're feeling, as long as they're able to make the right choices still. So if you bring a mindfulness to how you're feeling, your rotten mood or whatever, that maybe brings enough attention to the choices you're making, and you focus more on that. Be more careful in the choices you make. And that might make a big difference, actually. The other thing is, with very strong and comfortable states of mind, or heart or whatever, that using your mindfulness of the body as an anchor is very helpful, I find. If you have the time, if you have the luxury for this, is to go back and just spend some time feeling in your body, where it is in your body. Where is the discouragement? Where is the tightness? Where is the depression? Where is the anger? And just hang out there for a while. Let it kind of just resonate. Let it kind of just percolate or pop and percolate in that part of your body for a few minutes while you're being attentive to it. And that might also change your relationship to it radically. It might give you a little more freedom in the midst of it, and more ease in the midst of it. Noticing how you relate to it is one of the perennial good questions. You can ask yourself that, how am I relating to this yucky feeling?
I think it's the tendency that I want it to go away, or I want to run away from it, as opposed to, you know, all of that you're talking about, to me, has a sensation, or I can feel my defenses of, well, that's bringing me closer to that which I don't want.
And so sometimes discouragement is not because of X is present, but because we're unwilling to be present for X, because we're running away from it, or we're judging it. So a person might be, for example, depressed, and depression is unacceptable for whatever reason, and we're holding it at bay. And then really what's happening, the important thing to pay attention to there is maybe it's the resistance. And until you bring your attention to the resistance, the discouragement might be there. And once the resistance goes away, then you can just be with the depression in a simple way. So the very movement to try to escape needs to be brought into the light of awareness very clearly. Yes?
I'm a little confused about single-mindedness in the mind.
Simple-mindedness?
Being single-minded.
Single-minded.
It seems like I can think in four or five different levels all at the same time. It's confusing to me. I can try to concentrate on my breathing, and then thoughts will go on, and I'm still concentrating on my breathing. I'm having the thoughts. Then I can make a judgment about having the thoughts at the same time the thoughts are going on, and I'm thinking about my breathing. Then I can try to step back and recognize and acknowledge that I'm trying to step back and still have a judgment and still have the breathing and still have everything going on. Like four or five different levels, and it's confusing to me. I try to be single-minded and seems like a lot.
No, it's quite possible to have other things happening in the background of our mind like that. We're single-minded focus on the breath means that's where we keep our foreground of attention. It's where we intent, where our intention, the life force of our intention, we're going to devote towards the breath and keep that in the foreground. If there are things in the background that don't get in the way of our ability to keep the breath in the foreground, don't worry about the background thoughts or whatever. And then just keep that focus on the breath in the foreground, and give the breath whatever life energy, whatever life attention that you have access to, pour it into the breath. And don't worry about stuff on the back. And that'll take care of itself if you're able to keep pouring your attention to the breath. What might happen, however, is that you might have these two or three or four different things going on at once, and you might be with the breath, but you're not that interested in the breath. You're really interested in, you know, your analysis of the women's basketball scores, you know, at Stanford from the last game or something. I don't know. You know, whatever, I don't know what kind of things, thoughts you have, but, you know, you're much more interested in some theme. So really the operating thing where your life force, your life kind of intention is going is into this particular thought. You need to notice where the life is. What is juice and life for you in your mind? And what you want to do is let the life go into your breathing and let everything else kind of be in the background. And then notice when the life kind of leaves the breath. And sometimes the breath then feels automatic, or mindfulness breath kind of feels like mechanical then. But then you want to have the life there. And when the life leaves there and goes into some other concern, then you want to notice that and then bring it back to the breath. Is this making some sense to you?
Yes, it makes sense. I don't know if I can do it.
The other thing you might try doing, if you have this ability to multitrack with your thoughts, which some people do, is systematically go through all these different... Everything is then involved with the breathing. And if you have to judge, then judge the breath. Everything kind of centered in the breath. And that might help also things to settle down. Yes, please.
Is it possible to spend the whole meditation on your breath without any wandering thoughts?
Yes. I wouldn't expect it if you're just coming off, you know, if you're sitting a little bit each day, you know, one sitting a day or something, living a busy life. I wouldn't expect it. It usually comes with, you know, being on retreat, for example, and really building up some strength of concentration and mindfulness. But it is possible. Yes.
I'm having particular trouble with the breath in the last month or so. My therapist did a meditation for me. He taped it, and when I got home, I heard things that I didn't hear when he did it in our session. And he talked about the power of the breath. And to me, I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden, the breath seems really fragile to me and not powerful. And if you could inspire me a little more, or... I'm not sure why my thinking is going this way, but anything you could say about it would help, I'm sure.
You show me how you usually sit. Show me if you're, you sit.
I usually lie down because I have pain in my back.
Yeah, I see. And how do I see? You lie down.
With my knees up.
What you might try doing is taking take a towel and roll it up kind of like in a long roll, like you do sometimes in yoga, and lay it along your spine, so when you meditate on your back, this part of your chest and your stomach kind of gets opened up.
And then I would have a different experience of it.
Maybe. Yes.
When you talk about sitting and feeling it and just trying to feel where it is, how do you function? So say something's overwhelming you and you're feeling bad about something and you're allowing it to happen, it doesn't go away and you have to go to school or work or whatever. So how do you function? How do you get there and do that if those are intense feelings and you're trying to feel where it is and not stuff it or not do anything else?
Well, I think, I don't know how to answer that question. If I'm having some strong feelings that I want to pay attention to fully, I'll try to just, if I have the time, I'll stop and just be with it for a while. Go for a walk and be with it as I walk, or sit down and meditate with it and just be with it, and do it that way fully. If I have to take care of some things in life, then it becomes a little bit peripheral. And so I'm aware of it. I try to include it in my field of awareness so that I don't act unconsciously from it. But I don't try to really give it, you know, my central focus because I have to drive my car. Or, you know, and so, you know, so I kind of know it's there, but I'm not kind of bringing my full attention to it. And then maybe I come to a red light, maybe then I'll bring my full attention to it for a while and just be with it. And when the light turns green, I go back to driving. So, I mean, if we have to function in life, you know, we have to take care of what's around us. And part of the art of mindfulness is to know where our attention needs to go at different times. And if you're taking care of daily life things, you know, you don't want to be so. But if you're unconscious, if you don't keep one little eye in the periphery of your emotions, then you might find that you start, you know, acting unconsciously. So I make it a regular pattern. I have a very strong habit of constantly checking back in myself. It's kind of like even when I'm talking to you, while I'm talking to you, I'm mostly focusing on you and talking to you and reflecting on my thoughts, you know, and as I'm talking to you, I'm also paying attention to my body and what I'm feeling here, especially my stomach and my shoulders, and I feel little emotions, teeny little emotions that move back and forth as I'm talking. So mostly I'm focusing on here, but it's kind of like my attention very, very quickly is going back and forth. And so I'm tracking a lot of different things at the same time, but primarily I'm just with you. I don't know if that's helpful at all. Mm. Yes. Please.
Another thing for me, because, you know, I have 2 children, 3 and 5, so the, you know, my time to myself and to meditation is very limited, and I'm often challenged to bring mindfulness to child rearing. And the breathing for me is something that really works for that moment. It's like I have 30 seconds or less to decide whether or not I'm going to scream or toilet being destroyed, you know? And it's just, for me, it's when there is no time, you know, even just one breath will help sort of bring it back to something. I don't know, it just feels good, or allows me to do something right.
Yeah, I think it's very, very wise. So sometimes rather than focusing directly on something, once we've recognized that some strong state is there, we try to figure out what the wise way to relate to it is. And one of the ways to relate to it is to just breathe mindfully for a while. And breathing mindfully kind of quiets things down and lubricates the situation sometimes. So let's end with a short sitting. In the last couple of minutes of this sitting, see if you can discover the power that breathing has by really fully being with your breath, maybe even breathing teeny bit more fully than usual, And imagine that the breath, the breathing, is like getting a massage from the inside. I have a couple of announcements. The